Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I am Paul Strain, obviously over-anxious to get started with my colleagues. With my colleagues, Mr. Price and Mr. Ball, I represent Abbott in this action. And we have a handout for the Court, if the Marshal would so kindly pass it to the Court, handing out what I suggest to you are the three bedrocks for your decision today. The first being sections 4 and 5 of the Tort Reform Venue Statute of 2005, as written and without altering or deleting any words. The second being Rule 51 of this Court, which prohibits creation of venue by joinder. And the third being Rule 5205, your joinder rule, which does have limits and requires far more than merely the existence of common questions. Your Honors, there is a two-step going on in the Circuit Court for St. Louis City, which violates all three of those, and which is turning that court into America's courtroom. The plaintiff here is out of state, so Section 5 applies, notwithstanding any other provision of law, as Section 5 clearly states. But here, plaintiffs have made Subsection 4 control by joining the out-of-state plaintiff in this case with city plaintiffs, ignoring the provision of Section 5 that says notwithstanding any other provision of law, and in Section 4, which specifies where the plaintiff was first injured in the state of Missouri, changing the word the plaintiff to any plaintiff being first injured in the state of Missouri. By doing those things, presto, the Tort Reform Act of 2005 is transformed into a nationwide invitation to sue in the city of St. Louis merely by placing one city plaintiff on a mega complaint. This court's decision in Turnbow is right on point. My opponent's brief at page 41 said Turnbow does not require reversal, apparently because, I'm quoting now, it's no longer valid law. It is valid law, and Rule 51 is valid law, and they do require reversal. And I ask the court to look at the overwhelming misjoinder here. 24 plaintiffs from 13 states complaining about different, radically different warnings spread over 18 years, as if Ms. Kineski's doctor's decision in Pennsylvania in 1992 was part of the same series of transactions as Ms. Berry's doctor's decision in Oklahoma in 2010. And to justify that, the plaintiffs and the appellate court below relied only on two mid-20th century decisions of this court that could not be more factually different. For example, the Kelly decision, on which they rely, a 1947 decision. Very few people in this room were alive except for me at that time. That decision was a husband and wife living in the same house at the same time, exposed to the same chemical fumes for the same length of time. Of course joinder was proper, but of course it couldn't be more different from what we're dealing with. The Jackson County Circuit Court in Ellis versus DePue, which we discuss in our brief at page 66, got it right. You can't properly join these prescription drug cases. And this distortion of prescription drug joinder is being carried out in the Circuit Court for the City of St. Louis and nowhere else in this state. You said in Nixon versus Daley that decisions under Rule 5205 joinder should be in accord with decisions under Federal Rule 20. The Ellis decision in Jackson County is in accord. The decision below is way out of line with those federal decisions. And incredibly, post-trial, after all this joinder of 24 and 18 years, incredibly, post-trial, all of a sudden, the plaintiffs seek and get a Rule 74 order that this one case is a discrete judicial unit. Now, this is the tritest of all expressions, so I warn the court, it's coming. Have their cake and eat it too. They are the same transaction when it suits them to argue for joinder. They are separate, discrete judicial units when joinder no longer suits them. These 24 plaintiffs could never be tried together. There's no reason to conglomerate them into one complaint except to gain the venue statute.
They say there's the benefit of common discovery and some similar common issues as to which joinder makes practical sense, reducing the burden.
There could be that benefit, absolutely right, Your Honor. There could also be that benefit if they weren't on the same complaint. They could be coordinated for discovery easily under Missouri practice. So that is not a benefit that derives from being on the same complaint, but that would be a benefit from being handled together by the same judge. There really isn't any new efficiency from being combined in the same complaint. There's no.
We don't reach any of these joinder issues if you have to have independent venue in order to join another party. Is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do we reach these joinder issues if each plaintiff has to have appropriate venue considered individually?
We do not. Because if there's no venue, then the case cannot for each plaintiff, the case cannot proceed. Or if there's no proper joinder, then they can't try to get around the venue statute in the way that they have. But combining them in one complaint provides no efficiency, no anything. The 23 others in this case wait and wait. Discrete judicial units, they wait and wait behind a long, ever longer line of cases in the city of St. Louis. Your Honors, you can decide this case narrowly if you choose. You can decide that the joinder of these 24 prescription drug plaintiffs in Missouri is not proper under your Rule 5205. And that's not a discretionary decision below. You review that de novo, just as you did in Nixon versus Daley, where you reversed the lower court's decision under Rule 5205 without any mention of deference or discretion in the trial judge. It's not a discretionary decision, and this, even if it were, this is not a close call. This is overwhelming misjoinder. Frankly, if this is not beyond the limits of prescription drug joinder in Missouri, then there is no limit. But using such misjoinder, we've said in our brief what is going on, and it continues. Since this court's important decision in Norfolk, which was the same day as the first brief in this case, there are 16 more such suits with more than 1,000 out-of-state plaintiffs filed all in the city of St. Louis, and joinder is now creating personal jurisdiction. We've set that out in the ruling since Norfolk below at our reply at page 11. This case can be, I urge, should be, the important second step after your important decision in Norfolk to complete the job started in Norfolk. And I do need to mention, of course, the plaintiff has argued we must show prejudice due to an improper venue decision. Well, the prejudice, this court has recognized and everyone knows about the generous juries of St. Louis City. This court's own opinions in 1992 in DePaul Health and again in 2001 in Linthicum have recognized those generous juries of St. Louis City, and the drumbeat of headlines is a reminder that it continues and continues. This court's decision in Ego versus Department of Labor is direct precedent. No prejudice is required. And to say that Rule 84 layers on a requirement of prejudice for a venue decision is without support in any case, and so they have cited none. And that argument wasn't dealt with by the appellate court because the Rule 84 argument wasn't even presented to the appellate court. And I did want, if the court please, to spend a few moments on the punitive damages issue that we have raised. We have cited the Eighth Circuit opinion in Levaquin. Your Honor, will have seen that the Levaquin pharmaceutical warning that barred punitive damages under Minnesota law was neither upfront nor conspicuous. It was a single sentence embedded within 15 pages of fine print, as the Eighth Circuit said. By contrast, the Depakote warning is upfront, direct, and even all capitals. It includes the black box warning, which is the most serious type of warning the FDA allows. The Levaquin decision under Minnesota law cannot be distinguished, and so the appellate court didn't even try to. Yet this is the decision on Minnesota punitive damages law for pharmaceutical case warnings. The fact is, if Levaquin is right about Minnesota punitive damages law, then the lower courts here are wrong and punitive damages must be reversed.
Opposing counsel says that they presented evidence that you had greater knowledge and knowledge of greater defects and different defects, different percentage risk of defects than were indicated in your warning, and the mere fact that you had a black box warning didn't allow you to misrepresent what the research was and what the dangers were. And if you did that, would that, if the jury, what is your answer to that? Was there evidence which could have made a submissible case on that issue? And if so, wouldn't that justify punitive damages?
I'm very glad you asked that question, Your Honor. To justify ignoring Levaquin, the plaintiffs have said that our warning label falsely equated the level of risk from Depakote with that of other drugs. No witness said that. That is wrong. That is a post-trial manufactured argument without record support. The true testimony on that very point, we set out the record cites to that at pages 23 and 4 of our reply brief. And I urge the court, because of the importance of Judge Stith's question, I urge the court to look at those record references. That is a lawyer argument without record support. Thank you very much. I see my time is up. I'll
Thank
reserve.
You. We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Please, the court, as usual, I have something to ask you to take a look at.
Thank you.
Well, it's sort of difficult to know where to begin. But I think, as usual, in a case like this, you ought to begin with the statute. And the only way I respectfully suggest that you can reach the conclusion that Abbott wants you to reach here is to add a word between point four and point five, and that word needs to be "and." Now, several years ago, Judge White for this court wrote an opinion that says, when the legislature doesn't speak, it doesn't create an ambiguity. It merely indicates that the legislature is not speaking on that issue. In order to rule for them, you have to ignore a number of your cases and those of the Court of Appeals that suggest that there can be two proper venues in any case. And I would respectfully suggest that you have to ignore something that, frankly, we didn't see until we came here, and I don't think it's been in any argument, what the word "action" means. And I would suggest that if you look at the venue statute, they've given you one and I've given you one. The legislature says you start by looking at the action. Now, that word finds its way throughout the rules, and it finds its way even into the statutes, because our Rule 5205 is just a copy of Section 507040. And we don't have to get into the debate about which one wins, because they're exactly the same. And each one of them suggests that you start with an action. And the joinder statutes specifically permit a single action which combines people who are properly joined. And so if
action rules, can you please address the rule that says these rules shall not extend venue, 5101?
And I'm happy to do that, Your Honor, because in order to extend venue, there has to be a conflict. And the venue here is set out in two separate ways.
Well, the point, as I think you know, they're making is that if any of these people sued individually, they would have to individually sue venue, show venue, and they would not be able to show venue in St. Louis City except for the, I think, four plaintiffs whose claim their cause of action arose in the city, and that 5101, by saying you cannot extend the venue of civil actions by these rules, would mean that you can't, by joinder, grant venue where it doesn't otherwise exist.
And if it extended it, I would agree. But when the venue statute uses the word action, you have to figure out what that means, what you look at. And the action is the petition. And so the way this needs to go, I would suggest, and I think the reason we're here is not to review Minnesota law. You all didn't invite this case. It came unbidden. And it's here because the Court of Appeals wanted to know what you meant in Barker. What Judge Benton wrote in Barker, where he said that Barker was incorrectly stating that the question of venue is contingent upon proper joinder. But in every one of the cases that's subsequently decided, and even in that case itself, it says this: venue exists for all jointly liable or commonly liable defendants where it exists for one defendant. And that's all we have here, is one defendant. And venue is proper in St. Louis City and in St. Louis County for this one defendant.
Why is it proper for this plaintiff?
It's proper for the plaintiff because venue's not set up to protect the plaintiff. It's designed for the convenience, as Judge Breckenridge said in the Rothermitt case when she sat here in 1991, for the convenience of the defendant. And the defendant cannot be inconvenienced if it can properly, under the statute, be in both places. Now, all of these cases, and this is why the prejudice analysis is really important, arise from the time when this court said, and before the legislature changed the venue statute, from jurisdictional to merely procedural. And they're suggesting, and by the way, my memory is the case has come here as though the Court of Appeals has never happened. So if we didn't raise 8413 below, we can come up with anything we want to defend the judgment. And 8413 says that in every instance, you have to do a prejudice analysis before you can reverse a judgment. And the only prejudice that...
And do we ever do that when we consider venue issues prior to trial?
Well, Your Honor, this case has been here...
I'm not talking about this case. I mean, I know you're making the argument, and often after trial, in most instances we do, but venue is one of those things we can determine prior to trial.
You can determine it prior
to trial.
And
when we do that, have we ever undertaken a prejudice analysis? So is there some different element if we look after trial than before? Because I'm not familiar with any prejudice analysis then.
Well, the Igo case, which Mr. Strain cited to you, is a case in which they admit the issue of prejudice was never raised.
But I'm asking, is there any venue case where we've decided on writ prior to trial where we consider prejudice? Or would that be a first impression issue for this?
I believe it's first impression. This case came on a writ, as did a whole bunch like it. And you all have seen this issue over and over again. And if there's prejudice in this case, it is because this court had the jurisdiction to stop all of this, and it said, go right ahead. And so the plaintiffs went ahead and continued with the lawsuits and tried them after the Court of Appeals and this court said, we don't see enough here to stop the venue. That means it's not jurisdictional, perhaps, but if it's not jurisdictional, and it isn't, then Rule 8413 requires that you do a prejudice analysis. Now, frankly, I was amazed at the tort reform arguments in this brief, because this is a case in which your recent decision, Judge Stith, in Norfolk, would have made a death of this case had there been a personal jurisdiction motion filed in this case. And Judge Price and I were yesterday in the Court of Appeals in St. Louis in which one had been filed. But there is not one here. Personal jurisdiction was waived in this case. Venue is all that's left. And unless you're willing, and you certainly have the right, though I don't suggest it's consistent with proper judicial practice, to rewrite the venue statute, which the legislature is in the midst of considering and may or may not pass, but that's the corrective here. It's not adding words to the statute. And this so-called making St. Louis the courtroom for the world ended when you decided unanimously the Norfolk case, in my view, unless the United States Supreme Court says something different. And I've heard the oral argument in that case and believe that you probably have predicted correctly what's coming out of the United States Supreme Court. That said, why would you have to change the venue statute? And the venue statute says, look at the action. The action is a term of art. Now, the other thing I think it's important that hasn't come up is subsection 14 of 080010. And it specifically says that place of injury is a defined term. It says when you can sue because of multiple injuries, or if you've gotten in a car wreck in one county and the doctor malpractices you in St. Louis City, you have to sue where the car wreck was. It is not the first injured plaintiff, it is the first injury to the plaintiff. So I would respectfully suggest on this venue issue that if you simply apply the language of the statute, admit what the cases say, that venue can be proper in both places, that the word action invites you to consider the action, to look on the face of the petition to see whether or not the venue is proper. In this case, you would necessarily conclude it's proper in both places. And then you ultimately find your way to the place as you decided when you didn't take this, I understand not on the merits of the writs, that venue can continue in this case as it has currently been set.
Mr. Strain argued that the language in subsection 5 of 508.010, notwithstanding any other provision of law, is significant. Does that indicate that that provision supersedes the provision in 4?
I would suggest not, because the word action is in there. And that's why the word action, I believe, is so important. You don't have to look beyond that. An action is a specific term. We talk about it in the brief. It's the petition. You look at the petition. It's as though the venue statute says, look at the petition to determine whether venue on its face is proper. And that's what I would suggest. Now, and when you do that, you get proper venue in both of these counties. Now, I'd like to move on for a moment to Minnesota law. And I would suggest to you,
Counsel, before we go to the substance, if venue was correct, and if joinder was proper at the outset, is it possible that joinder, which was proper at the outset, could be true, but at some point prior to trial, a motion to sever could be made and it would be an abuse of discretion not to grant it?
Well, the rule permits it. Rule 5205 has specific provisions for that. In the event that the trial court, having allowed the joinder, determines that trying the cases all together would be prejudicial in some way to one of the parties. If that's the case, then it would be reviewed for abuse of discretion, just as the joinder is reviewed.
Well, not just to sever for purposes of trial in that jurisdiction, but to sever and either transfer or dismiss the counts where joinder may have been appropriate, but trial would not be.
Well, I think up until the time the judgments are final in all of these cases, any kind of procedural motion like that is fair game.
I mean, once it's severed, do you relook at venue?
I think under the statute, 012, you have to relook at the venue.
And so was this venue proper?
There's been no motion to sever subsequent to the original writ denials and all the rest of it.
And if it's not severed, then why is it a discrete judicial unit?
Because it was severed for purposes of trial, and you have a final judgment that under Rule 74 disposes of all the issues as these parties.
Do we relook at venue when you sever something for purposes of trial like this, if the only basis for venue was the joinder?
I'm sorry, I don't follow you quite.
The basis given for venue being appropriate was the joinder, because joinder had common issues and so forth. If severance is granted for separate trial because the issues are separate, does that then negate the basis on which venue was found to be appropriate?
There's no law on that, Your Honor. And until somebody tries it, I guess we won't know. But I would say the one thing different about this case than all the rest of them is simply the fact that this is a one-defendant case. Most of every other case is a multiple-defendant case. And that's why I don't believe there's much precedent that's been set by the Court of Appeals opinion in this, because this is a single-defendant case. The legislature should choose to fix the problem it can be fixed. But until then, I think it would be legislative for this court to add words to reach a different conclusion. Now, I've got a minute or so left.
What if this single defendant settled with all of the St. Louis City plaintiffs so that they were dismissed out of the case?
Well, Judge, the rules have always been you start at the beginning, and that's where you make these venue determinations. Obviously, there's lots of things that could be done later on that we haven't seen yet.
Didn't the legislature change the statutes, which that certainly was the case when you were on the court and when I first joined the court, but didn't the reform make it so you relook at venue when you add defendants or add plaintiffs at various times?
That's Section 012.
Right.
Yes. So it's not jurisdictional. I think this one defendant piece makes it important, and why I would respectfully suggest, unless you all are concerned about the general importance of the question of Minnesota, that the Court of Appeals opinion is just fine right where it sits. But let's talk for a moment about the punitive damages. I've got some charts at the back of this. This is a terrible case. I disagree with Mr. Strain's characterization of what we've said in the brief, but you'll be able to find it in the record, and we say you can. But this is not a warning which is basically benign. And putting a black box around something doesn't permit you to lie. It's a harsh word. I mean it. It says, and has for over 20 years, that the incidence of spina bifida with this drug is 1 to 2%. The evidence was it's over 10%. That's just plain birth defects. Spina bifida, 1 to 2% are in the warnings. The evidence was 20 times higher than that. This doctor testified, if he had known the truth.
I think it was 20 times higher than those who don't take the drug.
The background rate, that's correct.
Yeah.
And this doctor testified, if he'd been told the truth, he would have tried every drug first. This is the last resort drug, not the first. They were selling $1 billion a year of this drug, spending between $100 and $150 million on advertising. The idea was that this was their number one drug. They called it internally a dirty drug and their cash cow. And the record shows that they knew full well that if they put this language on their in the warnings, the cash cow would begin to leak milk. I'm out of time. I would respectfully suggest that this is a case that probably wouldn't have come here but for the fact that it came by itself. And perhaps it ought to be sent back. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Briefly on punitive damages, this argument, the lie that is said to be in the Abbott warning label, the trial witnesses said that is not so, including the witness, the primary witness called by the plaintiff below, Dr. Jacoby. We set out the record references at pages 23 and 24 of our reply brief. The trial witnesses below said there was no misrepresentation on that issue. If Levaquin is not enforced on Minnesota punitive damages law, the message will go out to all Minnesota prescription drug plaintiffs. Whatever you do, don't sue in your home state, sue in Missouri. That would be the effect of this. And on the venue, the important venue and joinder issue, we did again move to sever shortly before the separate trial occurred. The severance for separate trial made venue more stark, the lack of venue more stark. If it wasn't clear before, it should have been clear then. And in response to Judge Fisher's question, if the city plaintiff had settled or voluntarily dismissed, as happened in another Depakote case in the city of St. Louis, there would have been no venue, and the others would have been subject to transfer to St. Louis County, where they would have done, no doubt, what we set out one of the other plaintiffs did when transferred to St. Louis County, dismissed the case, and filed in their home state where they could have filed in the first place. The word action changes nothing. Subsection 4, which is what they rely on, talks about actions in which there is any kind of alleging a tort and in which the plaintiff was first injured in the state of Missouri, not any plaintiff was first injured in the state of Missouri. You can't change the statute by scratching out the and putting in any.
Well, doesn't that argument suggest that that statute applies only to cases with a single plaintiff?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor. That argument...
Well, how can you read that to mean any plaintiff when it suits you and not any plaintiff when it suits the opposing counsel?
Your Honor, that statute has Section 4 and Section 5, which are self-standing. Section 5, by its terms, applies when the plaintiff is out-state. Section 4 of 5 applies when the plaintiff is in-state. This plaintiff was out-of-state. Section 5 should have been applied. And I believe it's plain under the statute. I believe it's plain under the statute. And Norfolk, with respect, went a long way but did not resolve this problem. The flood continues. 16 more tort suits filed in the city of St. Louis, with 1,000 more plaintiffs just since the Norfolk decision. And in conclusion, we're urging this court to seize the opportunity to candidly protect the integrity of the system of justice in the state of Missouri. This St. Louis Circuit Court distortion of the venue statute should be ended. It is soaking the Missouri taxpayers and putting Missouri citizen suits at the end of a long, long line.
Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor, very much. We thank you all for your time and attention.
The case will be submitted.